Welcome to Creep Shows, where we discuss films that are just generally discomforting. I'm Ian.
And I'm Madeline.
And today we're talking about Hereditary.
This one freaked me out.
Yeah.
I didn't realize how much it scared me until going to bed that night. I had horrible dreams the whole night after watching this.
Yeah.
So this movie was directed by Ari Aster, and I forgot to look. Did he write this movie as well?
Yeah, writer and director.
Okay, that's what I thought. So this movie was filmed in Salt Lake City, Utah. It was released on June 8th, 2018. Has an estimated budget of $10 million and grossed $44 million in the box office in America. We watched this movie on Amazon Prime, so if you want to go watch this, if you have Prime or to rent on Amazon, because Ian is about to spoil this entire thing.
Oh, yeah. So, well, I like to do these summaries because there are some people that are interested in these movies and the kind of themes and things that they go over that don't necessarily want to watch them. Anyone that listened to the entirety of our last episode knows that I was pretty skeptical about this one. I don't like jump scares, and I was real worried that this one was going to have a lot of jump scares, which it did not, thankfully. And it has quickly become one of my favorite suspense, horror, whatever you want to call this, films just in general.
It was so good. I really recommend. You should definitely go watch this one or try to go watch it before we spoil it.
Absolutely. Before we spoil it right now, either just skip ahead or if you really don't want to spoil it, definitely go watch it. This is one worth watching. So here we go. So the film opens on a newspaper clipping of the obituary of Ellen Taper Lee, the eldest member of the family the movie focuses upon, who has just passed away in the family's home. The surviving members of the Graham family all prepare to go to the funeral. The film introduces Peter, the eldest son, who's a stereotypical high school stoner boy, Charlie, the daughter who has some kind of social disorder, Annie, the mother whose career revolves around creating scale model homes, apparently, and Steve, the father, who is a doctor. Annie eulogizes her mother at the wake, and it's shown that other than Charlie, who was very close to her grandmother, the rest of the family is either entirely uninterested in the proceedings or just actively despised Ellen. Once returned from the wake, Annie finds a letter addressed to her and some of her mother's belongings and is distraught to read that Ellen says she made a sacrifice in order to gain reward, an ominous note that brings on more questions than it answers. Shortly afterwards, the children are shown returning to their mundane school days as though the death of their grandmother was nothing noteworthy in their lives, but something sinister is clearly brewing when Charlie decides to sneakily cut the head off of a pigeon that crashed into her classroom window and died. That evening, Steve gets a call from the cemetery that Ellen's grave has been desecrated and that the corpse has been stolen. Annie later goes into group grief therapy meeting at a local rec center to air her feelings towards her mother, and the children deal with grief in their own ways, with Peter smoking a fat bowl and Charlie doing some arts and crafts the next morning. Charlie gets distracted by a strange light that shimmers over everything and seems to have a will of its own as it moves from the wall beside her over to the window to pull her attention along with it. As she walks out to her treehouse to follow the guiding light, she looks over and sees what appears to be her grandmother sitting in a clearing in the trees, surrounded by flames. Peter, meanwhile, is trying to convince his mother to let him borrow the car to go to a party, which he claims to be a school function in a typical teenage fashion. Annie agrees, but on the condition that he must take Charlie along with him. That night, the two teens arrive at the party, and Peter, just wanting to get high and get laid, against his better judgment, leaves Charlie out in the kitchen to get some cake being served while he sneaks off to a side room with his crush to get baked. Charlie interrupts him minutes later, stating that her throat feels like it's closing, implying there were nuts in the cake she had, which triggered an allergic reaction. Peter, lacking an EpiPen on hand, picks up Charlie and puts her in the backseat of the family car and begins driving to the hospital to get his sister the help she needs. Struggling to breathe, Charlie opens the car window and sticks her head out so as to force air through her ever-closing esophagus. At that very moment, Peter sees something in the road ahead of him and swerves to avoid it, which places the fast-moving head of Charlie squarely in line with a telephone pole that refuses to move aside. Charlie is decapitated in the blink of an eye, and Peter stops the car as fast as he can. Completely horrified by the accident, Peter silently sits with his feelings for a minute before driving back home, not looking at the aftermath of what has happened. He drives all the way home, parks in the driveway, goes inside to get in bed and try to fall asleep, unable to face the consequences of what has just happened and tell anyone. The next morning, Peter listens as his mother Annie is leaving for work, hears her get in the car ready to head out for the day, and discover the headless teen corpse of her teenage daughter hanging out the rear passenger window of her car. Annie lets out a shriek of unadulterated pain and terror while the camera cuts to a shot that finally shows the audience what Peter refused to acknowledge. Charlie's severed head in the middle of the road where it was separated hours earlier, now covered in flies and maggots, disfigured from the impact with the telephone pole. Unlike with the death of Ellen in the opening, the family is falling apart at the loss of Charlie. Steve, even in his stoicism, looks through some of Charlie's things. Annie sleeps through the cold nights in Charlie's treehouse, and Peter walks through life totally catatonic, lost in his guilt and pain. At one point, while smoking with his other stoner buddies under the bleachers at school, Peter has an episode where he feels like he's having an allergic reaction just like Charlie did before she died. Finally, after Peter comes home one night, Annie decides to go back to the grief counseling group, but upon her arrival, she decides not to enter the building. As she's turning around to leave the parking lot, she's flagged down by a woman named Joan, who offers a shoulder to cry on if she should ever need one. Peter, meanwhile, is trying to sleep and is awoken by the sound of a clicking tongue, mirroring a repetitive action always performed by Charlie when she was alive.
Ugh. Sorry, I just had to.
You just had to. So, one morning, Annie decides to take Joan up on her offer to listen and arrives at Joan's apartment, noting to Joan that she has a welcome mat that looks similar to those her mother used to make. The two women sit and grieve about their losses, with Joan revealing she lost two grandsons recently, two young grandsons. And as Annie continues to grieve, she decides it best to make a scale model of the accident that killed Charlie using her skills as a craftswoman, creating a macabre diorama of the scene as a form of therapy to help her process her loss. With her tension finally coming to a head at the dinner table one night, Annie reveals her inner conflict towards how she feels about Peter's part in Charlie's death, simultaneously blaming him and absolving him. One morning, soon afterwards, Annie runs into Joan again in the parking lot of a local store, where Joan begins to confide in Annie that she's found a way to commune with her dead grandson via a séance that she learned from a friend. The two women return to Joan's apartment, where she shows Annie the rite that she used and demonstrates the results, having her grandson's spirit move an empty cup that the ladies are touching. Annie, thoroughly freaked out, decides to leave, and after a night sleepwalking and hallucinating over Peter's bed, she finally decides to try out the séance for herself. Annie coaxes Peter and Steve downstairs to perform the séance and have Charlie move the cup, just like Joan's grandson did, but rather than move it just a little, the cup is instead hit with such a force that it shatters beneath the family's hands. Something shatters on the shelf behind them. Flame from the candle that's on the table grows 3 feet tall before extinguishing itself and lighting once again. The next day, Peter is plagued by his own reflection, smiling back at him at his terror while in the middle of his class. And now, at this point, things have clearly not gone as smoothly with Annie's seance as Joan's. With Charlie's spirit now back in the family home, Annie discovers a doodle book being populated with images of Peter screaming with X's over the eyes, which causes her to grab the book and try and burn it, only to be lit aflame herself, as though linked with the book by some magic. Annie realizes that Joan is the only one who can help her figure out why things went wrong with her seance and heads over to her friend's apartment. Upon arriving at Joan's, she gets no answer when knocking on the door and looks at the welcome mat and finally starts putting the pieces together. She returns home, tears open the box of her mother's belongings, and finds other welcome mats identical to Joan's, all sharing a strange symbol. She opens one of the books her mother's left, and that shares the same symbol as the mats, and reads a highlighted passage stating, "Payman, the god of mischief, takes possession of a vulnerable host after a ritual is performed." She looks through some of the photo albums in that same box and finds evidence that her mother and Joan were acquainted long before Joan ever offered her condolences in the parking lot of the grief counseling group, and they were both in the same group of people worshipping this god Payman. It is at this moment that Annie realizes that the seance she performed didn't bring back Charlie's spirit, but one much more malevolent that is intent on tormenting Peter and taking over his body. Peter, in school, is contorted and locked up in a demon armbar before an unseen force smashes his face onto his desk and bloodies his nose. Meanwhile, Annie, investigating the attic of the family home, where she finds the headless body of her mother, fully charred from fire and resting underneath the same symbol that she's found underneath on the welcome mats and in the Book of Payman. Steve picks up Peter from school after his run-in with this malevolent spirit, and when the two of them arrive home, Annie takes the opportunity to reveal her findings on her mother, Joan, and the horrors that have plagued the family since Charlie died. Steve writes her off, as any skeptic would, and Annie tells him to go see Ellen's body in the attic, which he does find, much to his disgust. Seeing her husband now faced with irrefutable proof of some shady dealings, she tries to convince him to throw Charlie's doodle book into the fire, saying that she can't because she knows it'll burn her along with it, and she's too terrified. After some arguing, she finally gets fed up, grabs the book from Steve, and throws it in the fire herself. But to her horror, it is Steve who is set alight instead of herself, and she stands there and watches him burn to death. In the final sequence of the film, Peter wakes up in the middle of the night, unaware that the body of his mother is possessed by some evil spirit and clinging to the ceiling of his bedroom, watching over him. He continues through the house to find Steve's charred remains, and then to the attic to find those of his grandmother as well, all the while being followed by this thing inside his mother that floats through the air behind him. He finally turns around to the sound of wet sawing and looks up to see his mother floating high off the ground with a wire saw wrapped around her neck, purposefully sawing back and forth until her head is separated from her neck. In terror, he jumps through the attic window down to the flower garden below, a three-story drop. And finally, the same light that was shown drawing Charlie's attention early on is seen again descending in a condensed ball into Peter's body. Peter stands up and follows the headless body of his mother, which is floating up to Charlie's treehouse, climbs the ladder up behind her, and emerges into a room filled with naked people prostrate on the ground. There's an effigy with Charlie's severed head on it, wearing a crown, and Peter's dead parents and grandmother prostrate in front of it, headless. Joan stands upright, places a paper crown on Peter's head, and reveals that the goal was to transfer Charlie's soul into Peter's body so Payman could have a healthy vessel in which to reside. Finally, it's made clear. The reward Ellen referred to in her final letter to Annie was gained by sacrificing to Payman so he would endow his followers with riches and influence. And that's it.
Thank you. That was a very good summary.
Oh God, that movie was so fucked up.
Yeah, and there were so many other layers to it as well that couldn't really be put into a concise summary.
Yeah,
so
you really can't put everything in this film into a synopsis without just being like, hey, we're just reading the script now.
Yeah, so
this was already pretty long.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting more into some of the layers with you, but this one fucked with me, especially oh my gosh, the scene of Charlie's beheading and Peter driving her. Like, I have a little sister, so that was really what got to me with this movie, especially because my sister and I have like the same age difference mm-hmm. that Peter and Charlie did.
Yeah.
Oh, so like, yeah, just knowing like if my mom would have sent my sister to a party with me and I had been drinking or smoking and ended up getting her into a fatal accident. Oh, I've had nightmares about that before watching this.
Oh, I know. And the actor that played Peter, Alex Wolff, did an amazing job.
I like, actually have some fun stuff to talk about with him, like, but he did such a good job in this.
The subject matter of this film alone is intense enough, but whoever did casting for this did a fucking great job. Holy hell.
Yeah.
Like, Toni Collette, the actress that plays Annie, the mother, Peter's Alex Wolff, they were two, like, driving forces in this film. Holy hell. Definitely worth watching for anyone who can appreciate good acting. Because I don't get much of a reaction from film most of the time anymore from acting. But, like, all the scenes between Annie and Peter, just that tension. Like, Toni Collette was a terrifying
oh, the
and
dinner
totally
scene.
Relatable maternal figure. Like, all those experiences where you've had arguing with your mom or something, like, all those feelings that I got came back with Toni Collette.
Yeah, exactly.
Because she did such a damn good job. Holy shit, that was impressive.
It brought back, yeah, feelings of any time I was fighting with my mom or knew I did something wrong, that, like, just feeling so apprehensive to go home to Like, this movie did such a good job. And one thing I read was Toni Collette was actually very hesitant to take this role because at this time she wanted to only do comedic roles.
Okay.
And after her casting directors and her agents pressured her to read the script, once she read it, she was like, okay, yeah, I gotta do this.
Seriously.
This is great. She was so good. Oh, no, but the dinner scene, just thinking about it, I have chills because...
It got me so uncomfortable.
It did, but in Peter's response more than anything was what drove it home. So the scene I'm talking about is Annie, Toni Collette's character, is going off on Peter for not taking accountability for what happened with Charlie. And yeah, just goes off on him that he never takes accountability for his actions. And he just very calmly replies to her, well, what about you, Mom? Charlie didn't want to go to that party, so why was she there?
Yeah. Like, the whole time she's trying to displace all of her frustration on Peter, who she's just admitted, you know, didn't actually have any hand of it, but she still hates him for being the vessel that, you know, that's how Charlie died, even though it's not directly his fault because he was involved. She can't get over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I mean, hot damn.
Oh.
So much conflict, like internal conflict, that all of these characters have done a great job of showing externally.
Definitely. Yeah. I have just a couple of little facts about some of the actors.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, real quick, back to Toni Collette. I did read that she called Ari Aster the most prepared director she's ever worked with.
Really?
Yeah, so I thought that was interesting because as we were talking about right before we started recording, this, he's done two short films. This was his first feature-length film, and then he did Midsommar. So he has he hasn't done a lot, but what he has done that we've seen so far is very, very good.
Yeah.
One thing I read about Ari Aster was that he requested that Alex Wolff, who played Peter, and Millie Shapiro, who played Charlie, go out to eat in character a few times. And so what ended up happening is they would sit up for 3 hours in silence while Millie just wouldn't speak and Alex would be trying to get her to talk. So that was kind of interesting to me, an exercise he had them do.
That is pretty interesting.
Yeah, just... I think this is fun fact because it's Broadway. Millie Shapiro, so she was 16 when this movie came out. She's 18 now. She was in the original cast of Matilda on Broadway as Matilda when she was 11. And so because she was so young when she was in this role, they did this on West End for Matilda as well, is they would have four actresses who played Matilda just because of labor laws and also not wanting to overly exhaust the young actors.
Yeah.
So she was one of four girls who played Matilda in the original cast. But in 2013, she won an Honor Tony along with the three other girls who debuted as Matilda, making them all the youngest recipients of the award.
Well, that's cool.
Yeah. And
good
then,
for you, Millie Shapiro.
Yeah. And then Alex Wolff. So I don't know. I'll get there because I don't know if you'll remember this or not, Ian. So something funny about him is he offered to break his own nose during the movie.
Okay. Like, Shia LaBeouf.
Right? Yeah. he did his own stunt for smashing his face into the desk. But he went to Ari Aster and was just like, yeah, I don't need a pillow. I don't need a cushion. I'll break my nose. I'll do it.
Damn, that's hardcore, dude.
Yeah, they didn't let him.
I can't imagine why.
He did start bleeding for realsies during the scene, though. But it was because he injured his knee, like banging it against the desk.
Yeah.
Wasn't actually his nose. He is 22 years old now, so he's the same age as I am. He was 20 when this movie came out. And so, Ian, do you remember on Nickelodeon, between 2006 and 2009, Around the same time, Disney Channel branded the Jonas Brothers, which was the first band I ever saw live.
Gross.
They were opening for Allie and AJ. We didn't know who they were at the time, but I saw the Joe Bros back in 2006. Pretty cool. But do you remember when Nickelodeon tried the Naked Brothers Band?
I vaguely remember seeing like commercials for it. That was out of my age range at that time.
That's what I figured. But so that was Alex Wolf and his older brother, Nat Wolf. Yeah, they were the Naked Brothers Band.
Okay.
I grew up in a Disney family. Like, I basically wasn't allowed to watch Nickelodeon.
Oh.
I mean, you know this. I didn't watch Avatar for the first time until, like, quarantine.
Blasphemy.
I know. Blame my parents.
Parents blamed.
But, so, yeah, Alex Wolf and his older brother, Nat, formed this band that their parents were their managers for.
Mm-hmm.
But they've both gone on to do acting. Like, Nat Wolf, his older brother, has been in a few John Green movies, which you wouldn't have seen.
No, probably not.
But those came out when I was in high school, so I saw them. But, yeah, every time I see Alex or Nat Wolf, I just can't help but think the entire time, Naked Brothers Band.
Yeah, well, Mr. Naked Brothers Band smashed his own face into a desk for a horror movie, so.
He's evolved. He really has.
Yeah, no kidding. That was an intense scene, too. His eye was kind of bloodshot, and, like, he was contorted all in a weird way and just smashes his own face and then screams a bunch. Like, holy hell. That movie was intense.
Yeah. Oh, and I told you when we were watching the scene of him, looking... Oh, of his reflection smiling back.
Oh, yeah.
That's one of my biggest...
I fully understand this. I've had, throughout my childhood, I had nightmares of Bloody Mary. Like that stupid kids game where you flick the lights on and off and say Bloody Mary into a mirror a bunch of times.
Let's go play Candyman.
So, yeah, I totally understand that fear. And, oh, God. I even have a hard time now with mirrors in the room, like, in eyesight at night.
I know, you do.
Someone's going to fuck with me. I don't like this. Yeah, no, that was a creepy scene, too.
Oh.
And just the whole tongue click thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the closest this movie came to a jump scare was that scene with the mirror. Like, because you hear the sort of background noise. The sound design in this film was fantastic, just for anybody that loves the sound design. I can't really put it into words because I don't have that much experience with sound design other than just knowing when to appreciate it. And sound design in this movie was great because there's like this buildup of just like kind of noise, tones, and, you know, Peter looks over, sees his reflection in the glass of like a bookshelf in his classroom, and it's just his own reflection smiling back at him. And to cut out of it, you just hear the disembodied from Charlie. And it made me poop myself a little bit. Like, I don't know if you remember, but I legit jumped.
Oh, that's funny.
It was awful.
Oh. For me, honestly, I think the most, like, jump scary moment of this movie for me was... Also, I just bumped my mic, so sorry if that was...
Really, it happens.
Yeah. But no, the creepiest part for me was right in the beginning when Toni Collette's character sees her mother's apparition.
Oh, I know.
I thought that was the most jump scary part of it.
I know. I peed myself a little bit there too. Don't worry.
The rest of it, I just thought was great suspense and just great storytelling. Like, I loved how this was very much a horror movie, but it wasn't a jump scare horror movie, kind of like you were saying. That's why you don't like a lot of more current horror movies.
Jump scares, at least in my opinion, jump scares are what you rely on when your storytelling isn't creepy enough. It's just like, hey, how can I make people shit themselves and get their heart rates elevated? Ooh, jump scare, flashing lights, loud fucking trill sounds, like, let's do anything that we can to startle people. Like, that's not horror. That's just being an asshole.
Yeah, but this was storytelling. Like, this is very much about a grieving family. And this kind of leads me into what I wanted to talk about with you.
Yeah.
Is just throughout this movie, too, we aren't really sure if Toni Collette's character, especially, if she's really experiencing these things or if she's having a psychotic break.
Yeah.
Because in the grief counseling scene or the grief group, she talks about her family's history with mental illness, how her brother was schizophrenic. There was something with her dad too, but I mainly remember the schizophrenia. And she's talking about this in the way of her mom's life. And she's like, yep, that was my mom's life. And it's like, no, honey, this is your life. Yeah. I thought the way that monologue was played was just very smart. But we see Toni Collette's character kind of views herself as this ticking time bomb of mental illness because she knows it's there. She knows it's a prevalent thing in her family. So anytime she experiences something, she could just chalk it up to stress, you know, like seeing her mom in the beginning, she could just say, oh, it's stress. But then in the back of your mind, you have to wonder, am I showing signs of schizophrenia? Am I losing what I think is my grip with reality?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I just kind of want to know what your thoughts are on how this movie showed mental illness.
I think it did a great job because too often in film, we see things portrayed in black and white in very certain terms. And the thing that this film did very, very well is that it doesn't define a large majority of what's going on very clearly. Like it leaves it to be ambiguous. Because you know, that's how life is. You know, you don't get a clear-cut answer. You don't get a black and white sort of response to things. You get varying shades of gray. Like, for you, it's the grief counseling scene that really set it. For me, it was her dinner table confession to Peter and her expressing her feelings about him and towards him. Because, like, you see her flip-flop in that monologue. You know, she goes from saying, oh, you know, Peter, I know it wasn't your fault. I know it was an accident. And then on the other hand, by the end of it, she flips it around and she's like, it's all your fault. I know it was you. You're the worst. And it's just like showing that inner conflict. I think that was really well done. And you see that in various ways, like you're saying with her seeing her mother. What is that scene? Like she's in her little workroom or something like that. The light's on. She turns off the light. And then as the light's turned off, you just see the mother, like this apparition of her mother pop up behind it in the dark. Super fucking creepy. But like she doesn't tell anyone about that. She struggles with that as something just for her. You know, she doesn't tell her husband. She doesn't tell her kids. She doesn't tell her therapy group. She doesn't tell Joan. She doesn't tell anybody. That's something that she keeps to herself. And as someone who's an extreme introvert can tell you, you tend to do that a lot when it's issues with shit that you just can't wrap your head around.
Yeah, you know, definitely. I think
you find these things, you keep them to yourself, and you hope that you can figure them out before they cause other people problems. And I think that that was really well shown in this film.
I
think that's one of the main reasons I actually really like it, because it was so ambiguous and self-contradicting. It was much more human, much more relatable.
Definitely. Too, another thing that really stuck out to me was her and her sleepwalking. She does talk to Joan about, but especially the scene where it looks like she's sleepwalking and she goes into Peter's room. And Peter asks her basically why she hates him. And she admits that she never wanted to be a mother.
Yeah.
You know, she tried miscarrying. It, you know, doesn't give details, but take that how you want. She tried to force a miscarriage multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
She admits that she never wanted to be his mother. And so we learn through that that it was her mom that forced her to have kids. And, you know, I think we then learn that she forced her to have kids so that Payman could have a body to come into. Because I think that's, maybe I'm jumping ahead, but I think the term hereditary, I think it goes towards both that your mental, you know, like mental illness can be hereditary. Also that this sort of evil predestination is hereditary.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Really honing in the point of that as much as we try to reject it, your family can determine your fate.
Yeah, it's very true. I think everyone can agree with that to some degree.
Yeah.
It was definitely sketchy. I mean,
it was a good movie.
Being the modern cinema goer that I am, the entire time I was trying to just like figure out where the movie was trying to go in like the first half. I was just trying to predict everything. And I was thinking, like, early on, we see some sort of carving above Charlie's bed, and it says Satony, S-A-T-O-N-Y. And so I figured, like, when we first watched it, I was thinking, okay, that's like a weird, you know, 13-year-old phonetic spelling of Satan, but like in Latin or Italian or something like that, because it sounds like one of those Romance languages, Satany, right? And so I was thinking that, like, oh, maybe she's a part of it. Maybe Charlie is, for all that time that she supposedly had spent with her grandmother and how close they were, like, maybe Charlie's in on it. Maybe she knows what she's planning. And we never see it explicitly stated that she was aware of it. But I think just based on the fact that we see, like, she's making the toys. And, like, we have a scene in her school where the teacher comments, like, hey, make that toy later. You see that same toy later on in a diorama of the final sequence of the film with this effigy of Charlie and the severed heads in front of her. Like, you see that toy in a diorama of that at Joan's house. So I think what's implied is that Charlie was in on it from the start. She knew what to expect. She didn't know for sure, like, that she was going to die. But I think she knew for sure that she was supposed to be this vessel for Payman, and that there had to be some ritual to put her in another body, because we see her with the pigeon head, like the pigeon head that she cut off.
Oh, that scene fucked me up.
That was a fucked up scene too. Yeah, just. But like, we see the pigeon head in that diorama.
Super foreshadowing.
We see the toys that she made in that diorama. So like, she knew something. If she wasn't aware of everything that was going to happen, she definitely knew some of what was going to happen, and she was involved in it.
Okay, yeah.
So that's what I theorize. We don't ever get confirmation, but I'm pretty sure that Charlie knew what was up to some degree, and I think she was in on it from the start.
Okay. Yeah, you watched through the movie again today.
I scrubbed through just to make sure I was getting all the major beats.
You're always better about picking up on details like that than I am, though, so it's cool that you noticed that. I was thinking actually about like the symbols, and I talked about this too, is something that we saw Ari Aster do in Midsommar as well, is we see the use of bears in symbolism a lot. And so I'm not going to spoil Midsommar right now.
Great movie. Go watch it.
Yeah, go watch it. Also on Amazon Prime.
Hey.
But Ari Aster likes to use a lot of symbols throughout his movies that then come in full circle at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Also, what is it with him and doing just focus shots on bodies being attacked by flies? Dead bodies being attacked by flies?
I don't know. I mean,
he has a thing for it, I think.
The guy's definitely got artistic flair. That cannot be denied. In one of the things that I saw about him, he went to film school, but he also went to an art school in Santa Fe in New Mexico.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he went to an art school as well. So aside from just his film schooling and education in filmmaking, like, he definitely has an artistic side of what he creates. And so, I don't know. You could debate artistic choices all day and never get a right answer. But at least for me, what I think of when I see like those long held shots on corpses and on just like gross, disgusting stuff is just his way of showing like, hey, you can't escape this. We know you don't want to think about it, but you're going to think about it because I'm not showing you anything else for the next 20 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Like the shot that we see Charlie's severed head in the street. Like, they held on that shot for a good 20 to 30 seconds, and you're just sitting there like, I want to look away. There's nothing else on screen, though, but I want to look away. Oh, but there's nothing else on screen. It was so gross, and yet you want to look at the whole thing, like, take in all the details because there's nothing else that you can do. It's not like it's not like other movies where you see a severed head for like a quick flash, like, oh, what's in the box? And then it's a quick flash. Like,
that's Seven, right?
Shh, don't spoil.
I've never seen the movie and I've already had it spoiled for me.
I know.
I think
that that's just a way of just solidifying the horror. Like, hey, you know what happened. Think about it. Think about why it happened. Think about the consequences. Like, there's nothing else you're going to be thinking about during this 20-second hold on this messed up looking severed head of a 13-year-old. Like, hot damn. So that's the whole reason that I think he does it. Yeah. I don't know about you.
Now that I think about it, a lot of the weird dreams I had that night included flies.
Okay. Ooh. Maybe it was just the fact that we watched The Fly. No, that's not.
No. I don't know. Because, you know, like, I can't even remember what my, like, bad dreams were. Like, I didn't have nightmares, but I know I even woke up at one point in the night and was just like, I'm having a lot of fucked up dreams.
Yeah.
But I don't remember what they were.
Yeah, I get that.
This movie does a lot of disturbing imagery in my mind.
Talking about disturbing imagery, I know we're kind of jumping all around the film. Admittedly, other than the stuff that Madeline's going to get into in a bit, because this film's so recent, we couldn't find a whole hell of a lot of interesting background details on it. But talking about disturbing imagery, the thing that kicks off that kind of final sequence with Peter in the attic where he finds his grandmother's body, and then Annie is floating behind him.
Oh, yeah.
So she's floating like 6 feet off the ground, just like stark upright. And you just see her like moving her hands back and forth towards her neck. And at first I thought she had like knives or something like that.
I thought it was a knife at first. Yeah.
I thought it was like a knife in her hand or something like that. And eventually I had to realize like, oh, it's not, she's not like stabbing her head off or anything like that. There's an actual like a wire saw. So I looked it up. Wire saws are real. It's just like basically steel cable that's really, really sharp.
Yeah.
In between like two wood blocks, like basically like a garrote that you would see assassins kill people with in assassin movies or something, where it's just a wire. And like she had it wrapped around her neck and she was just sawing back and forth. And I didn't realize that's what was going on. But oh God, that was just such a horrifying sort of thing to see. As you just see her floating up there, wide-eyed, just stoically
cutting
just
off her own head.
Like sawing back and forth. Ugh. So gross. Yeah. And as soon as her head hits, or as soon as he sees it, Peter fucking jumps out the window, just goes, ah!
He just nopes the fuck out of there.
Leaps out the window. So what I want to know is, what do you think? Do you think he died there from that fall, or do you think that he was just knocked out and then that's when the spirit took him over?
So, okay. And this is, I'll talk a bit more about this. Uh-huh. My last little bit that I actually found stuff on. At first I thought that maybe he did die, but I think that maybe he was just very close to death, mm-hmm. or at least unconscious. And that was when the spirit was like, okay, this is my opportunity.
Yeah.
Like, this body is in its weakest state right now. I can take over. I definitely think, though, that Payman Charlie's spirit entering Peter's mm-hmm. body would have definitely killed him, or would have just, you know, overtaken Peter's spirit to where Peter does no longer exist as we knew him.
I see what you're saying.
So I definitely think Peter's spirit is dead at the end of it, but I don't know if I think he actually died from that fall. I'm not sure.
Yeah. No, I found it really interesting that in this movie of such ambiguity, we actually see the ball of light entering Peter's body. Like, I thought for sure that we weren't going to be able to see that, because even after that, other than seeing this weird little lighting effect enter his body and then he walks into this final ritual in the treehouse, like, you get the feeling from the look on his face that Peter might still be in there, might still be aware and just totally skeptical. And I don't know, I got the impression anyway that Peter was still in there to some degree.
Okay.
And just like, who the fuck are all these people? What has happened to my life? What has happened to my family? Why is this happening? And I thought it was really interesting that it kind of went back to one of the first things that we see of Peter in school was a discussion of some literature that I don't remember. Basically saying that the main character is tasked by the fates to proceed with their destiny, basically.
Oh, Hercules.
Was it Hercules?
I'm pretty sure it was Hercules.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't remember. But yeah, so there was this discussion, and the teacher talks to the class, and the teacher's like asking, okay, so knowing that this character's fate was determined from the get-go, does that make it more or less tragic? And one student says, it makes it less tragic. Teacher goes, why? Student's like, because. He just fucking leaves it there. But another student answers and says it makes it more tragic, basically that, you know, through all of these hopes and dreams that this character had, that it turns out that it all means nothing because they're just a cog in a machine that they never could have changed, that sort of thing. And I think that that final sequence, I think that the long held shot on Peter as the paper crown is put on him, as Joan is telling him like, hey, you're payment, welcome. I think, at least to me, it seemed like that part of the film was Peter still being Peter, none of this having been real at all, and just him making that same debate in his head.
Okay.
Of,
ooh, I like
is this more tragic or less tragic that all of this has happened to me because of this crazy group of cultists?
Because it was already his fate.
Because they'd already predetermined it, right?
Oh, so, I like that interpretation. Yeah. I'm going with your interpretation.
Yeah,
now.
So that's why for me, like, you can lend as much credence as you want to all the seancing and the demon summoning and shit like that. But ultimately, I think Peter is still around at the end, and I think he's just having that debate. And that's where the film ends.
Yeah.
Such a good movie.
It was so good. Well, okay, before I get into my last bit.
Yes.
Who is your favorite character, and what would you rate this movie?
I'd give this one an 11 out of 10 on the creep scale. It creeped me the fuck out, and it was so good and actually makes me think. Like, as much as M was my first 10, that's because that was the pinnacle of what I had previously been able to define under suspense and filmmaking. This gets an 11 out of 10 for me because it just blew all my preconceived notions out of the water. Like, I thought I could have it figured out and just didn't. So definitely this movie is fantastic. One of my favorite horror movies ever. And if I had to pick a favorite character, it would be Annie. Toni Collette was just too goddamn good. She's so relatable. She's so humanized. Every monologue that she had was just full of conflicting emotions and just the human experience. She did such a good job. I can't think of anyone else as a better character.
Definitely. No, I'm glad she didn't turn down this role. A lot of people, like a lot of critics, just fans, think that this is her best acted role ever. The only other thing I've really seen her in is Knives Out. And I mean, she was funny in that.
She was great.
That was a good movie, too. No, I would also have to give this one an 11 out of 10, kind of like you. For the first half of the movie, I was like, I know where this is going. I figured this out. And then at a certain point, I just had to accept, like, I'm just along for the ride.
You just had to accept that you know nothing, Jon
Snow. Yeah. we can watch more Game of Thrones soon.
I know, eventually.
I'm just so mad at Ramsay, but I'm just so
keep
mad
on task. Keep on task. Come on.
I'm sorry. I'm so mad at Ramsay Bolton, you guys. Sansa deserves so much better.
Don't worry.
No, this was a great movie. I knew it was going to be good going into it just because I'd heard so many good things about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was great. I was going to save this for the very end, but I'm going to go ahead and read it now, and then I'm going to go into my last little bit fun tidbit.
Okay.
So our friend Justin from Not Just Any Book Club podcast sent us another review this week, so thank you, Justin.
Thanks, Justin.
So I'm just going to read this. Hereditary is a horror movie where the horror is its weakest aspect. I was so invested in the characters and how the film was not afraid to show the emotional aftermath of a tragedy. The film doesn't use this time to build tension, but instead build character. It is bereft of the modern horror tropes and instead focuses on the character. It makes no attempt to scare you, but instead emotionally discomfort you. When the horror does come into play, it almost completely forgets what made the film so great. It abandons the restraint it practiced in favor of cheap thrills that contradict the emotional focal point. Having Charlie be an evil child makes everything feel pointless. So much of what makes the film great is abandoned after it favors shock over craft. What started off as a bold drama ended off as a cheap horror film. It had me and lost me. So thank you for that, Justin.
Yeah, thanks, Justin.
That was a bit of a different view on it than
definitely
we
a
had.
Different take than what we had.
Yes, so I always appreciate when you guys don't agree with us.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So hopefully if you do listen to this, maybe my little theory about the final sequence might change things around for you. I don't know. But this movie, I would say, regardless of your first feelings on it, if you love it or if you hate it, I think at the very least it's worth a second watch to reevaluate everything. So
definitely.
That's my two cents.
All right. I want to talk about the occult.
What? Madeline? The occult? No.
All right. So I'm just going to go through this. And
tell us all the spooky shit that you found.
Real quick, though, I do just want to say, something that I study in school is religious studies. I find it very interesting. That being said, if anybody, any of our listeners practice any of the crafts I'm about to talk about, and you feel I don't accurately represent these groups, or in any way say anything disrespectful to your beliefs, please let me know. I take that very seriously, no matter what your faith or practice is. So I just want to say that before I get into this.
Thanks,
if I
Madeline.
Offend you, let me know. Okay, so one thing that we see throughout this film is the seal of Paimon, the symbol you were talking about. This is, in fact, a real symbol. It is actually Paimon's seal. And so Paimon is one of the four kings of hell in classic demonology.
Okay.
And so there's demonology, and then there's demonolatry. Okay.
Demonology and demonolatry.
Yes.
Okay.
Sorry, reading the word, I stumbled on. Demonology, demonolatry. So demonology is the study of demons, as well as it can involve ritual magic involving demons. So the magic typically involves demons known from the books, The Lesser Key of Solomon. It is a 1904 grimoire, which is also a spell book. The terms can be used interchangeably, or the Grimorium Verum, which is believed to have been written around the mid-18th century, and that is a book on black magic and demonology, and so is the Lesser Key of Solomon. It's not as much, from what I could find, black magic, per se. It's just more focused on demonology. So some of the more popular demons from these books, specifically Lesser Key of Solomon, are Lucifer, Paimon, Astaroth, and Beelzebub. There are many other demons, though, and there are 72 demons alone in the Lesser Key of Solomon. So that's kind of demonology. So you study demons, you can practice magic along with it, sometimes summoning them, but it's different than demonolatry, which is the practice of raising demons up to the level of gods and worshiping them as such. And so, from my understanding, within the magic community, this is kind of seen as a taboo practice and is very much the minority of people who practice magic. And so someone who practices demonolatry, they will worship one or more demons like deities. And not everyone who worships demons in this way practices magic, but a lot of them do. And so some of them may have an altar dedicated to, the example I found was Paimon, actually, and pray to it, whereas others will hold festivities that are very similar to pagan ones, except instead of worshiping Thor or Odin, it's Lucifer or Beelzebub. And this is also different than people who practice Wicca. Wiccans and people who practice, you know, what I saw of this is it was classified as a practice of Satanism. So Wiccans are different than people who practice this demonolatry. The term sorcery is used pretty interchangeably with people who practice the demonolatry as well.
Okay.
And so I'm going to talk a bit now just about how we see it in Hereditary and how it compares to real life practices. So the methods we see of summoning Paimon in Hereditary consist of lighting candles, carving triangles into wood, inscribing invocational words of power, and sacrificing humans for the demon to manifest.
Mm-hmm.
So while these methods of conjuring a spirit are based in actual historical depictions of summoning demons, they are equally fictitious. And an example of this is in Paimon's description, there are the words, three will come before him. The movie interpreted this as three people will be sacrificed before he manifests.
Uh-huh.
So kind of like that little distinction there, like how the movie took these actual words and actual, yeah, just these actual words, but how they interpreted to play them out.
Uh-huh.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
And so in this movie, the goal is to allow Paimon to manifest on Earth by possessing a human. I saw that this was similar to Rosemary's Baby, which was actually, I read, a big inspiration for Ari Aster.
Okay.
And it also parallels the story of Jesus or Hercules, this divine being coming down into a human body and, yeah, divine spirit embodying a human. And so modern hermetic magicians have theorized that it is possible for a human soul to become displaced, often in a near-death experience, and for a spirit to move in and take over. That's why I said my ending.
Okay, yeah, when he leaps from the attic, falls into the garden, he's almost dead.
Almost dead. He's just almost dead yet.
Love it. Go on.
He's only mostly dead. I won't go down into this rabbit hole right now, but look this up on your own if you want. But this is also thought to be the true inspiration behind the myth of changelings.
Okay.
Yeah. So bringing it back around a little bit to the demonolatry. I'm struggling with this word,
You're never
going to
get that one, are you?
I am not. Demonolatry.
Demonolatry.
All right.
Go on.
So while real magicians frequently use a triangle of manifestations, that's like the triangle carvings we saw, words of powers and candles, this is not how you summon a demon. The true power of magical conjuration is Kabbalistic, meaning they are under the authority of the divine, whether that be a higher god or a demon, they are under the authority of the divine creature. And so it is often taught in occult circles that without a connection to the divine or the demon, it cannot successfully be summoned and can cause great havoc and chaos. Contrarily, demonolatry holds the idea that if the demon is served well, sacrificed to, or, you know, you just buddy up to it, it will eventually take sympathy on you and will give the magician what they want. And so this is refuted by most classical spell books and most modern magicians. And so the two ways that we can distinguish people who practice demonology is a magician who works Kabbalistically, which means through the divine source themselves, they believe that you have to have the spiritual connection to whatever you are trying to summon, versus someone who just thinks that, you know, out of acts of service, sacrifice, you will win the demon's favor. And those are the people who are typically labeled as a sorcerer.
Okay, interesting.
Yeah, and so most practitioners will sacrifice very little or nothing to a demon and will see signing a contract or pact as something that will ultimately have negative repercussions in life. So in this movie, what we are seeing are people who practice demonolatry versus demonology.
Yeah.
And again, that is the minority of people. However, I did find one example of a pretty well-known spell book that does encourage signing a pact.
Okay.
Called the Grand Grimoire. Although different editions date the book to 1421 or 1521, it is believed that it was written in the early 19th century. And so this book actually instructs the sorcerer into making what is a classic pact with the devil. You sign a contract with a demon called Lucifuge Rofical. I'm pretty sure this was a French book. Mm-hmm. I'm probably wrong on that. But the name of this demon means the one who flees the light. That's pretty self-explanatory. It's a demon.
Sounds pretty straightforward.
And so the sorcerer is told to make numerous sacrifices to summon Lucifuge and then sign the contract he presents in order to be in servitude of him in exchange for a great blessing of success in life. And so that's kind of what we see in Hereditary is we see the three family members sacrifice, because the sacrifices would be grandma, Annie, and the husband, I believe, right?
Yeah, that's what I would assume.
That's my understanding.
Considering those
too.
Are the three headless people in front of the effigy of Charlie's
head. Yeah, I would say Charlie also became headless, but she had like a prophecy to fulfill, pretty much. So that's kind of what we see with this movie, is more of a group that has signed, what I think is that they've signed a sort of pact with Payman. And yeah, have agreed to give him these sacrifices, these things in exchange for him coming to Earth in the form of a human to lead them and be their Messiah.
Sounds about right.
Yeah, but that's what I have on that. Again, you know, if one of our listeners practices any of these things and you don't feel I talked about it in an accurate or respectful way, please let me know, because I got my information from the internet, which isn't the same as an actual
Listen, everybody knows source. The internet is 100% reliable regardless of what resource you choose, okay? We know this. And for anyone out there unfamiliar with sarcasm, that's what that was.
It was so hard to tell on you.
Hey, you never know. I mean, we probably have people that will listen to this eventually that learn English as a second language, and sarcasm's harder to pick out. Honestly, it's not something that translates over from language to language in my experience.
Yeah, that's true, I guess. I mean, I've never learned really another spoken language, but sarcasm in ASL even is a lot different than spoken, so I can see how it would.
From what I learned of Mandarin, like, sarcasm just doesn't exist in Chinese. My teachers used to yell at me for trying to be sarcastic. They're just like, what is that? We don't understand. That's Maybe they funny. Were just old fuddy-duddies. I don't know.
That's funny. Your tonal inflections aren't registering.
I don't get it. You're not being sarcastic. You're just being wrong. It's like, okay, sorry. Good times.
All right. Do you have any last thoughts on this movie?
Yeah, my last thought is, go watch it if you haven't seen it. Do yourself a favor.
Even if we already spoiled it all for you.
Even if we already spoiled it all, at least watch it, because the summary that I gave does not do justice to the story.
Or the acting.
Or the acting. Even if you know the story beats and you know how it might play out, go watch it. It's a damn well-made film. Anybody that likes film just in general is going to enjoy watching this if you have the stomach for the content. But do it. Watch it. It's fantastic.
If I could stomach this movie, you can stomach this movie.
Yeah, this is one that even my mom could watch if she wanted to, and she doesn't have a stomach for this kind of stuff. So do it. Watch the movie. It's great.
Yeah. All right. Well, do you want to announce next week's movie? Do you remember what we're doing next week? I do.
I don't remember, but luckily for me, I've got this nifty calendar right next to my face that tells me what we're doing for next week. It's going to be a film that I'm going to have a hard time understanding, because my understanding of it so far is that there are very, very strong religious overtones. So this one's definitely going to be more in your wheelhouse, Matt. But the movie that we're doing for next week is Mother.
Some good old J-Law.
Yeah, Jennifer Lawrence, film by, what's his face?
I don't know.
I even know his name. I've seen a bunch of his other movies. I don't fucking remember his name right now. Darren Aronofsky. That's what it was. He's most well known for films like Requiem for a Dream and Pi. Apparently Mother is super fucked up, so we're gonna watch it. It's gonna be a lot of disgusting fun, hopefully. And I don't know if it's anything's ever gonna top Hereditary.
Yeah. Also, I'm sorry, I keep forgetting to look up before we start recording where we're gonna watch next week's movie on. Keep an eye posted on Twitter and Instagram.
Yeah, we'll figure it out eventually and let people know.
Yeah.
But if all else fails, we'll probably just have to rent it if it's not streaming anywhere, which I'm fine with. A couple bucks here and there, not too bad.
Yeah, we can do that.
Awesome.
All right. Well, thank you so much for listening. If you have movie suggestions for us, you can send them to creepshowspodcast@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter and Instagram at creepshowspod. You can support us on Patreon at patreon.com/creepshowspodcast. If you listen to us on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a 5-star review, as you know it helps us out. And we hope you join us next week. Stay safe out there. Bye.
Bye-bye.